The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
And then you get this scene as more and more bin Ladens come aboard in Orlando, then in Washington, then in Boston, of a sort of mournful family reunion that reflects some of the diversity of the family under enormous pressure. So some of them are crying, some of them are reciting Quranic verses, many of them are chain smoking. You get these young kids, college kids coming aboard in Boston complaining to the security guards that they just gotten their first fake ID for use in Boston bars, not going to do them any good when they get to Saudi Arabia. And so, you know, in this sense of being reacquainted, they depart and fly over the Atlantic.
And were you able to get a count of how many bin Ladens were on that flight?
Yeah, if we had the manifest in front, I don't have it in my head, but there were about 19 to 20 people on the flight, of whom three or four were friends of the family. The rest were bin Ladens either by birth or marriage.
Now, this suggests that there really were a lot of bin Ladens in the United States and that their business interests and their activities were extensive. Before we go back to the beginning, can you summarize or characterize just how deep and broad were the bin Laden activities and investments in the United States?
Well, beginning in the mid-70s and continuing right up until 9/11, various members of Osama's generation of 54 bin Ladens had extensive involvements in the United States, led primarily by the eldest brother who ran the family for 20 years, who we'll talk about later, Salem. But including other brothers, several who attended USC, one or two of whom graduated from USC, another cluster attended University of San Francisco, one got an engineering degree from UC Berkeley, several others attended and studied engineering at the University of Miami. And some of those brothers and sisters stayed after their schooling and went into business or came back to go into business. And, for instance, in Los Angeles, there was a cluster of businesses run by Khalil bin Laden, who operated from Ventura Boulevard and Sherman Oaks and ran a company called America in Motion, which was entered into eclectic endeavors such as trading shares in an Arabian horse owned by the country singer Kenny Rogers, buying and brokering vintage aircraft with a company in which Clint Eastwood was involved. Mainly they trusted things they knew. So airplanes, horses, real estate were preferred over securities or speculative endeavors.
And the real estate, as best as I could tell, the real estate holdings were most extensive in Florida?
Florida was, there was a compound, a family compound near Disney World, which was a real center of attraction for the family over the years. At one point, Salem wanted to create a potential refuge for the family should the Saudi royal family be overthrown, and he bought plots, adjoining plots, just near Disney World, and his fantasy was that each brother and sister would have their own house next to one another, and they'd all be at Disney World, and this would be where they retreated when the Disney-like kingdom of Saudi Arabia went down in revolutionary flames. And so that, and then each of these houses would be named after a flower and so forth. But Florida, yes. Texas also, California, and then the Boston area. Those ended up being the four principal locations for the family.
Well, this all started with a man named Mohammed bin Laden over a century ago. Tell us about him, where he came from, what sort of life he had when he was young, and how this developed.
Well, he came from there, actually. Well, his father came from there. That is the bin Laden ancestral village in southern Yemen in a remote area called the Hadramaut, a remarkable place. It was glorious to travel there. I was invited by the governor and finally was able to go to the place where the bin Ladens really came from, which turned out to be a different canyon from what I and lots of other people had believed was their origins. And you can see just a glimpse of the landscape there, but in the days when Muhammad's father was a young man, he was farming some of the ground in that sandy valley, and he had a plot that was no bigger than this stage. That was his land. And the only way to farm it was when floods came. You'd had to gather the flood water and irrigate temporarily, try to sow some grain or wheat, and hope that you could feed your family from it. Anyway, he migrated under threat of death from this canyon after an ox he'd borrowed died, and ended up in a canyon just over that wall, a good day's walk away, where Muhammad was born along with his brothers and sisters. And Muhammad's father died, and so he was essentially orphaned, and as a boy walked out of these canyons to the sea and migrated to Saudi Arabia, where he arrived just in time for the Great Depression. And I'll continue the story briefly of his success, but let me just remember how to advance this, because these are the bin Ladens who are still in Yemen. I have to say, they were the most cooperative bin Ladens I met in the course of this research. They're the ones who are waiting to be rediscovered by the rest of their family, but they hold the oral history of the family, and they still live in some hardship in this original valley. But to pick up Muhammad back up, he arrives in Saudi Arabia as a teenager with his younger brother, essentially sleeps on the ground, hustles, works as a porter, learns to be a contractor, acquires a small contracting business, waits out the Depression, waits out the Second World War. And after the Second World War, as the oil boom finally arrives in Saudi Arabia, well, then he begins to make this great fortune, because it turns out that he has a real intuitive genius and a charisma. He's an illiterate man with one eye from a childhood accident, but he ends up becoming the most successful builder in Saudi Arabia.
And what do you attribute his success? You write a lot about his relationship to the Saudi royal family. How did that relationship come about?
Well, he ingratiated himself with the family in the period after the Second... That's him. In the period after the Second World War. You can see his good eye there winking at you. He ingratiated himself with the family when... After the Second World War, they really began to enjoy the oil wealth that had been discovered during the Depression, and they sort of behaved like a big family that had won the lottery, and they overspent in grandiose ways, built a lot of palaces, encouraged, in truth, by American oil companies to consider the possibility of luxury in an American style, and Muhammad built his company by essentially learning how to work with the idiosyncrasies of the royal family. Initially, the royal family invited in big international construction companies like Bechtel to take on projects, say, to build a road between Jeddah and Mecca. And
the U.S. Embassy encouraged the royal family to use American corporations to do this, right?
Yeah, there's all this amazing correspondence about the American Embassy always trying to maneuver to get companies like Morrison Knudsen and Bechtel into the game. But what these companies found was that if you wanted to work, at least in this era in Saudi Arabia, you'd start working on a road and your phone would ring and it would be a prince and he'd say, "My refrigerator is broken." And then you'd send someone over to repair his refrigerator, and the next day he'd call and say, "You know that big grader that's out there working on the road? I'd actually like to borrow it for 6 weeks because I'd like to dig a sunken garden at my palace." And eventually, Bechtel decided, you know, life is too short, and they weren't able to cope not only with the demands in the workflow, but also with the erratic payments, and it was just an early, you know, early state formation would be the way the political scientists would put it, and Mohammed bin Laden, every time one of these international companies left in frustration, Mohammed bin Laden seemed to be right there saying, you know, "I'll do the job the way you want it done, sir." And he had this ability to make himself useful. He essentially operated as a kind of concierge service for the royal family. And if they needed to pay him in a chicken farm instead of cash, which they did in one case, he said, "I'll work with that chicken farm, Your Highness." If they needed to wait 6 months to pay him, he would wait. And he also had a great talent for swarming the job. He would just bring laborers to a site and get things done in a hurry if that's what the royal family needed.
And he also, as a result of this process, ended up with very key contracts in Mecca and Medina.
He did. He became by the early 50s, the sole authorized builder in the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, and also in Jerusalem.
And Mecca and Medina were undergoing huge renovation projects, right?
Yes, because as the guardians of the two holiest sites in Islam, the Saudi royal family felt that it should spend its oil wealth to create a fuller experience and a more comfortable experience for the pilgrims who came each year on the Hajj.
I was left with the impression from reading this part of your book that it was really those projects in Mecca and Medina and the road building projects that turned bin Laden's company into a very large company.
I think that's correct. And the road building, though, was also tied up with these defense projects, because by the 60s, they sort of became the Halliburton of Saudi Arabia in the sense that the royal family returned to them repeatedly for no-bid contracts involving sensitive foreign policy problems. So when they were at war with Yemen, with Nasser essentially in Yemen, and their whole southern frontier was exposed, they had to build covertly in concert with the Americans and the British a massive defense infrastructure in a short period of time, and the bin Ladens won that sole source, no bid contract, you go down and do that. And this is an important element because it explains Afghanistan. The Afghan war in the 80s, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, was also an authorized sensitive defense and foreign policy project. The bin Ladens were there, Osama was there, as a representative of the family, and there's a form of continuity in
well, this there's work. Also a thread to 1990, the Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, and the bin Laden's involvement with the U.S. Army at that time,
yes.
When the Americans come. But we'll get to that. But there's a
yes.
vein there as well,
yes.
It seems to me. What were the circumstances of Muhammad's death?
He at the time was working primarily on the Yemen frontier, where in addition to these defense projects, there was an enormous push to build infrastructure into this very poor and remote and mountainous part of Saudi Arabia. And so he had a bunch of job sites out there, and he was illiterate and really only had Arabic as a language. He was nonetheless a modernizer, and he was the first private Saudi to have his own airplane, and the first private Saudi to buy his own jet. And he wanted his children educated in the finest schools and so forth. And he used these planes to fly to these job sites way out in the remote areas of southern Saudi Arabia. And he had a crew of American pilots, mostly Americans. There were some Pakistanis and others. And he had a new American pilot who was flying him down to a particularly difficult site. And one day in September of 1967, this pilot flew into this strip marked by rocks, got caught in a crosswind, tip-tilted, fell to the ground, and Mohammed bin Laden and the pilot died instantly in a fire.
Who emerged after that as the leader of the family? I mean, actually, you should tell us how many sons there were and how difficult it was to figure out then who should lead
in the context
of this.
Inspired by the example of the Saudi kings and crown princes, he had married many times, interpreting Islam's permission to hold four wives as a permission to have one or two senior wives with whom he was married for long periods and had many children, but then one or two sort of positions in his court that rotated on a 2 or 3 year basis, and if that often. And so by at least 22 wives, he had 54 children, 25 sons and 29 daughters. And at the time, these children... He didn't start having these children until the mid-40s, after he'd really started to establish himself as a businessman. So this generation of 54 was born between 1943 and his last son was born after his death and named for him Muhammad in 1967.
In fact, some of his children were born within days of one another. Right?
Now, Osama was one of 7 children born within a sort of 3-month cluster in 1958. So there was a particular period in the late 50s where he was fathering at an unusually rapid pace. And that's where the sort of the middle child that Osama, the middle child syndrome that seems to have affected Osama took place.
A unique middle child syndrome.
Yes, a unique middle child. But anyway, his eldest son at the time of his death was Salim, and he was in his early 20s, and he was in England away at school.
So tell us about Salim. Salim, it seems to me, is in a way the central character in your book, or nearly the central character.
I think he is. Yeah.
And is so totally different than Osama that it bears talking about him some.
Well, he was, as a researcher, sort of the gift that kept on giving, and he was in the Arabian tradition, I mean, let's set the stage. His father disappears suddenly on a September morning. The eldest of these 54 children is only in his 20s, barely out of boarding school, has no business training. There's really nobody prepared to take over this company. It's a $150 million company involved in massive construction projects all over the kingdom, including some very sensitive defense projects. So the king appoints a board of trustees to try to keep things going while he figures out what to do. But Salim comes back from boarding school in England ready to take over the family. In the Arabian tradition, he'll be the emir, the boss. All things will run through him. Well, so who is he? He's recently been playing in a rock and roll band in England called The Echoes. One of his fellow musicians eventually goes on to marry Emmylou Harris. He is an enormously charismatic and gifted but very playful young person. He ends up as a pilot and a rock and roll musician and an adventurer. He collects private planes. He begins to move around, not just Saudi Arabia, but Europe and the United States. He crosses oceans one day and then back the next. He flies to Paris for dinner. He marries and divorces and starts to collect all sorts of relationships all over Europe and the United States with girlfriends, some serial, some simultaneous. He ends up learning to be, he has this innate desire to perform. And the principal thing that he's remembered for by his friends is taking the stage to sing. And
he sings old-time American songs.
He sings his favorite song. He likes Beatles songs. He sings House of the Rising Sun in seven languages. He goes to band leaders at every party in Los Angeles he's in. He pays $200 for the right to take over the band while they're on break. So he goes up to the microphone, grabs a guitar, or finds an accompanist, and he sings House of the Rising Sun in seven languages. Then, if the audience is responsive, he says, okay, now come along, we're all going to sing together. And he leads them in On Top of Old Smokey, She'll Be Coming Round the Mountain. Those were two of his favorites. And then in Germany at Oktoberfest, he does the same thing, $500, let me take the stage. And he starts leading the whole crowd in German folk songs that he barely knows, that he's memorized on the flight over. He plays the harmonica, but not with more enthusiasm than talent in the estimation of his friends. Here, let's bring him up onto the screen. That's him in boarding school with his best friend, his Turkish school friend, who was nicknamed Baby Elephant. Baby Elephant's in the foreground, Solomon's leaning over his shoulder. And that's the famous vacation picture. We'll come back to that, that 70s show. There's Solomon with the sailor hat on his yacht. And there he is skiing at Snowmass. But he was more than a jet setter. He was a very talented character.
I was going to say, you spend a lot of time describing the fun that he had, spending a great deal of money. And then you get around to talking about the business deals that he developed and built. And he built the company into a much, much larger affair. And I found myself wondering, how did he have time to do both of these aspects of his life?
But he used this personality to essentially put himself on equal footing with the CEOs of the largest corporations in the world, who were all had, you know, many of whom were very talented in business, had much training, some, and who were much older than him. And he only took meetings in bed, which sort of leveled the playing field if the CEO of Volvo was at issue. He was a very American character, very egalitarian. He liked to move around. He didn't have time for snobs. So there's this great story where he's at a business dinner with the CEO of some big company and in the United States, and somebody brings a bottle of wine, and the man sends it back very ostentatiously. He's unsatisfied with it. And Solomon gets up as if he's going to the men's room, and he goes into the bathroom, and he lays down a couple $100. He says, "Give me that bottle back. Give me another bottle." He then takes the second bottle, empties it, pours the first bottle into it, recorks it, says to the waiter, "Okay, here's $100, reserve it." And the guy comes back out, and of course the businessman makes a great show of approving of the new bottle. And Solomon calls him out and cuts off their business deal right there. But you know, he didn't like Palm Beach, where the Saudi royals tended to prefer.
So he goes to a place called Panama City?
Yes, right? Which, as you know, the true Floridians know, is properly known as the Redneck Riviera. And that's what that's where he likes to be with these pilot friends. Basically, he's comfortable in jeans. He drives around in broken down rabbits and Corollas and so forth. That's just how he preferred to live.
There's a whole American entourage that grows and grows and grows, and you could talk about a lot of them, but it seemed to me that it'd be worth asking you about Jim Bath.
Yes, well, Jim Bath was this character who's perhaps well-known to some of you if you reside on certain websites late at night, because he went to... he was in the National Guard with the current president of the United States, and he also invested in some of George W. Bush's early oil companies or partnerships, which didn't succeed. And there had been some question about whether some of the money that he invested in those was actually passed through from Salman bin Laden, with whom he was also doing a great deal of business. But Bath represented more broadly a kind of moment in Texas entrepreneurship that was in the 80s, the 70s and 80s, that was just out of control. And even by his own account in the records of divorce and other proceedings that followed the kind of crack-up of this lifestyle, it was, you know, it was living large in a way that even Solemn didn't countenance. I mean, Solemn was not someone who went over the edge, but the world that of oil sort of travel and adventure that Bath belonged to did go over the edge.
As Solemn was building this company in the 1980s, where was Osama? What stage in life was he, and what was his relationship to the wider family and the family's business interests?
Well, he collaborated with Solemn during the 80s on the Afghan War, but just to back up, Osama, his mother was 15 when she married Osama's much older father. She seems to have been, it's a little bit murky, the circumstances in which she was essentially bequeathed to this traveling businessman two or three times her age by her very poor Syrian family in coastal Syria. But perhaps it was with the prospect of employment for some of her male relatives, or perhaps there was some other aspect of it. In any event, Mohammed took her away, and as was always the case with these wives with whom he was united for only a year or two, once she became pregnant, he recognized her as fully legitimate. He recognized her son Osama as fully legitimate. But he divorced her after a year or two and arranged for her remarriage to an executive in his company, somebody with a steady salary. And so Osama, with his teenaged mother, entered this new household, which became in Saudi terms, a sort of conventional nuclear household in suburban Jeddah. But Osama is literally the golden goose, because he is the reason that everybody has an income and everybody has the prospect of an inheritance. And so he grows up in this step family, and he is sent away to Lebanon to a Quaker boarding school for a short time. Doesn't stick, he comes back. He ends up in a prep school in Jeddah that is modeled on the British curriculum. The boys all have blue blazers and gray flannel slacks and assemble in the morning for their English and Irish teachers. And there are also, however, Syrian and Egyptian teachers there who are exiled members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And shortly after his father's death, Osama was recruited by his Syrian gym teacher into a study group that indoctrinated him in this political Islam. So as a Muslim brother, he becomes part of the high school Islamist clique at this prep school, which is a swelling group of young Saudis in those days of the 70s. And then he goes, to answer your question finally, he goes to the Afghan War as a volunteer, essentially as a religious studies volunteer, a teenage brother who's going to go do great works in this righteous anti-Soviet war. But as we were talking about before, he's in Afghanistan as an authorized representative of Saudi foreign policy, of the bin Laden family, and for that matter, fully in alignment with American foreign policy at the time. And so Solemn supports him. And Solemn comes out there with his rock and roll hippie entourage to visit with him, provide him money, videotape him for fundraising purposes, and ultimately to sell him weapons.
Solemn flies his plane to Peshawar in Pakistan once or more than once, and they're with some American, some members of his American entourage?
Yeah, well, the one story that's the most full, that I was able to document the most fully with interviews with several people who were on the trip, it began as a hunting trip that Solemn was undertaking with Saudi princes, and he wanted to entertain them with hot air balloons and ultralight aircraft, so they'd have a good time hunting for bustard by falconry. And so he went to San Antonio, Texas, and he walked into an ultralight store and he bought everything they owned. And then he discovered that the salesman played rock guitar, and he said, "Oh, well, then I need you to come with me to Pakistan to take care of the Saudi princes, help fly these planes." So this guy, George Harrington, goes off on the trip. They go to Dubai. They fly in hot air balloons. They get in a private plane. They fly to Pakistan. Parenthetically, the Pakistan Army says, "You're not bringing hot air balloons into this country." So they're turned back at the border. They go out into the desert, and then one day Salim says, "Hey, we got to go see my brother Osama." So George has no idea what that means. And he and this Swedish mechanic named Bengt Johansson, who is a chain-smoking sort of hippie-ish character who hung around with Salim, they all pile into Salim's plane, and they fly up to the frontier. They land on a dirt road, and then Osama comes out to greet them. And Salim is there with a big, clunky, early video camera to take pictures of Osama's activities and to help him raise money.
Did you see the video?
No, people told you about it, right? George and Bengt both describe it in on-the-record interviews as to what happened. I do suspect that that video, and they and another person who was on the trip describe how Salim then sent that video back to Washington, where King Fahd was on a state visit to President Reagan. And I do wonder, as a researcher, I went to the Reagan Library, there's quite a lot of materials that are still classified. I wonder if someday some account of that reporting will surface, because if you read Reagan's speech very carefully, he seems to be referring to something that he's been told about Saudi humanitarian activity that we now know Salim had just documented 2 weeks before. So in any event, I only go where the evidence takes me. That's as far as it takes me.
there's always been a question about whether Osama's activities in Afghanistan in the 1980s were supported in any way by the CIA.
He wasn't directly. The CIA had some direct unilateral, as they're called in the trade, clients, people to whom they gave cash directly to report directly to them about things they saw and heard, or to support their warfighting activities. Osama was not a direct CIA client, and I've never been able to document a direct meeting between himself and any serving CIA officer. Both Osama and the CIA deny that such meetings took place. I think it's entirely plausible. This is not to suggest he was not a creature of the CIA program. His main Afghan sponsor, Jalaluddin Haqqani, who's still a fugitive from American justice, was a direct CIA client, and he was Osama's main sponsor. So, I mean, it's sort of meaningless in political terms. But the point is that I've always been, researching Osama's biography for 15 years, curious about what Americans he ever met, and apart from journalists. And the answer is he met these hippies, or these adventurers, these rock musicians, these pilots. Hippies is probably unfair to some of them, but in any event, these rough adventurers who traveled with Solomon, those are the Americans he seems to have known.
What about his relationship to Saudi intelligence?
He was directly collaborating with Saudi intelligence.
Explain what that meant.
Well, the Saudis had a sort of two-track policy during the Soviet phase of the war. They provided matching funds with the United States to support the main effort in the war. But they also had their own program separate, which they kept separate from the United States, and they operated through charities and representatives. And Osama was a sort of fully authorized, in this kind of Halliburton model, representative of the bin Ladens and of the Saudi government on the frontier.
And you said that his brother Salim, there came a point during the 1980s in Afghanistan when Salim began to support Osama's military activities. Can you talk about that a little
bit? Well, there's this one arms deal that I was able to describe with on-the-record interviews in 1986 when the United States was supplying Stinger missiles to its clients. And Osama apparently, I'm inferring this, but he apparently got wind of these supplies and said to Salim, "I want my own missiles. I'm not getting any of these Stingers." So Salim, through a German friend, arranged to fly Osama to London and put him in a suite on Park Lane at a hotel. And he came into the meeting with one of these pilot friends of his and some other sort of part of the European adventurer entourage. And they'd found some brokers who were willing to sell him SAM-7 missiles from South America. And they go into the meeting, and Salim essentially says to his friends, "Okay, look, my brother is really, really religious. So, you know, be very serious, no jokes, and you better treat me like a sheikh. We'll be out of here in 45 minutes, and also put out your cigarettes." And they went in, and this was one of several connections to international arms markets that I was able to describe. I think also he bought weapons from South Africa through either the Saudi government or his family.
Did Osama have a role in the business, the bin Laden business?
He did. He was a junior executive. He was a fully enfranchised son. So this idea that he was, sort of the son of a slave or somebody who was treated in a humiliating way is just not true. He was a junior executive. He was treated appropriately to his station in the family, which is to say that he was not one of the elder brothers. He was not one of the ones who had been sent to the United States for the big civil engineering degrees to prepare them to run the company. But he had a business, he'd studied business, and he was given junior executive positions in various offices, including Medina. And he was fully enfranchised as the shareholder in the two main companies. And that made him actually even more enfranchised than a number of his brothers. So he had dividends coming to him in the early 1970s in the $200,000 to $300,000 a year range minimum, tax-free in 1970s dollars. And then he earned salaries on top of that as an executive, and as the company prospered, of course, all the shareholders prospered.
And did that flow of money to him continue in the 1980s when he was in Afghanistan?
Absolutely, yes. And then there was a point after Salem's death that when the father died, the estate was not passed through. It was not liquidated and distributed in cash or shareholdings. The principal legacy of wealth that Muhammad left was the company, which was still operating, and the Saudi royal family wanted it to survive. And so there seems to have been some sort of argument within the among the brothers about how to handle the distribution of principal. And Salem in particular seems to have delayed the distribution of principal. But after he died, there was a decision made to actually pass through a chunk to everybody, and at that time, everybody got somewhere between $8 and $15 million. You could take it in shares, you could take it in cash, you could take it in a mix.
When did Salem die?
He died in May 1988 at the Kitty Hawk Field of Dreams, which I am not making up is the name of an ultralight park outside of San Antonio, where he went one Sunday morning after attending the wedding of one of his American pilot's sons, at which wedding he had stood up and sung his usual corny songs. Oh, another one of his typical performances was to say at weddings, and he did this at the wedding, for instance, of Anwar Sadat's daughter. So it was not just, in Texas that he did this sort of thing. He stood up on the stage and he said, "Now, for this very special—I can't do an Arabian accent, but he had a rich one. And he said, "For this very special occasion, I have written some poetry." And then he reaches into his pocket and he pulls out writing on a roll of toilet paper. And he says, "This is where I can concentrate and do my best work." And then he reads out a very funny and affectionate poem. And anyway, he was at this wedding on Saturday night. And then the next morning, he had nothing to do. And some of his pilot friends said, "Hey, let's go fly ultralight." So they go out to the Kitty Hawk Field of Dreams and they're goofing around on motorcycles. And Salem has breakfast and then he gets in one of these little light aircraft. They only fly, couple 500 feet in the air, and he goes up. This is a guy with thousands and thousands of hours at the helm of Lear jets and Bach 111s, I mean, every Gulfstreams, and a very talented pilot by all accounts, and pilots don't, they can be stingy with their praise about peers, but they all recognized him as a natural, and he was experienced, but he was a bit reckless. He'd take it out to the edge, but this morning he comes up in this aircraft, and he levels off. And he's doing nothing. I mean, he's just flying level. And there is a video that's been taken of this. I wasn't able to possess it, but I've had it described by five or six people. There's just no doubt about what happened. He comes up, and in clear daylight, he flies into some power lines and tips over, falls down, and dies instantly. And he may have had tearing in his eyes. It was windy. Some of his friends describe him while skiing into trees because he had an unusual degree of tearing in the wind, but nobody really knows what happened.
You mentioned that after Salem's death, there was a distribution of money to the members of the family, and the figure that you use for the money that may have gone to Osama was, I think, $9.9 million.
Well, he was divested. He was forced to sell his shares in the two principal family companies in 1994 after he had sort of moved to Sudan and started to write these angry pamphlets about the Saudi royal family. And the Saudi royal family essentially came to the bin Ladens and said, "Look, you know, we're making you rich with these contracts, and your brother is fomenting revolution. Can you do something about this? And eventually a decision was taken to force his divestment of the shares. And when he sold his shares to one of his brothers, he was given $9.9 million for those shares. And that was put into a trust in Saudi Arabia, because under Islamic law, it was judged by an Islamic court in Saudi Arabia that even if Osama was a criminal and no longer a Saudi citizen, it was not fair to deprive his heirs of his wealth. So it was being held for potential application by heirs at a later date. And in fact, the question of what happened to that $10 million, how it was managed, is the subject of current litigation involving the victims of September 11th, who want to know if Osama has any money that could come to
them. So how rich did Osama get by the time that he breaks with his family and the Saudi royal family and becomes an international criminal? There is a controversy about this figure.
Well, I mean, it was a controversy because the U.S. intelligence community reported it incorrectly for a long period of time, including right up to 9/11. The dominant reporting was that he had inherited $300 million, and that the implication of this was that he could self-finance. But in fact, his wealth was at the scale we've been discussing, and by the time he was in Sudan and actually causing trouble, he'd run through quite a lot of that money. And in the course of this reporting, did the thing that reporters do, go to a lot of courthouses, dig around looking for old lawsuits and things. And in L.A. County Superior Court, just here, I had probably the most eureka-ish moment I'd had in a courthouse since I was a kid reporter. I was down, and there's an archive. If you go look at archived lawsuits in the L.A. County Superior Court, you have to drop like down under the earth in downtown L.A., and there's a basement down there where people go to get their records in order to have divorces and things, and there's like a little subterranean world, and there's microfiche down there that has old civil cases. And so I was down looking up old cases involving companies that I knew the bin Ladens had involved in various things, and I came across a divorce involving one of Osama's half-brothers who had been living in L.A., married an American, and then divorced her, and she became suspicious about what she was being told about his income. And this was a 1991 case sitting in open microfiche in the L.A. County Superior Court, and she hired a forensic accountant and sent the accountant to Saudi Arabia to investigate whether what she was being told was accurate. And this accountant came back and reported accurately to the court about all the things we've just been discussing, or many of them, and gave a very specific picture of the family's finances. And that thing was sitting there right up until 9/11, but both President Clinton and President Bush, while dealing with one of the most important national security problems on their plate, were being told over and over again that his wealth was $300 million, all cash, and that he was self-financing.
And there's no evidence that that was in fact the case.
There's no evidence at all. No, I think that was just rumors. That's just flat wrong.
When he returned to Afghanistan in 1996, when al-Qaeda was established and when al-Qaeda had carried out some terrorist activities, did he have any money at all then?
Well, actually, we now know that he was really stripped of what little he had by the Sudanese as he left. He had this period of exile in Sudan, and then he was forced out of Sudan under American pressure. And as he left, the Sudanese essentially just stripped him out of everything he had. And so he ends up getting to Afghanistan with broke, angry, abandoned by a couple of his wives, abandoned by his eldest son, and with the empirical knowledge that the United States had forced him into this condition. And when he arrived in the summer of 1996, he essentially climbed a mountain outside of Jalalabad and wrote a long declaration of war against the United States, which is, you know, from his point of view, he thinks the war we're still in.
One more question before I open it up to the audience. In looking at the history of the bin Laden family and in discovering all that you discovered about their wide activities and what they did, do you feel that you understand Osama bin Laden any better?
Yes. I think I understand him as a bin Laden in ways that I didn't. I mean, I think for obvious reasons, he's mostly been, by me and others, understood as a creature of transnational Islamic radicalism, as a creature of the Afghan war, a creature of the upheavals in the Islamic world after 1979. He is all those things. But there are several aspects of his accomplishments that I now see for myself as inextricably rooted in his membership in the bin Laden family and his inheritance of talent and understanding from his father and his brothers. The first is his embrace of modernity, and his ability to use the technologies of global integration to innovate as a terrorist. After all, his first big strike as a terrorist was involved the use of a satellite telephone to hit two American embassies in Africa simultaneously while never leaving Afghanistan. And this was at the same time that the rest of his family was investing in Iridium, the first attempt to build a phone that could be taken anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world with one telephone number. So he uses aviation and satellite telephony and media as instruments of his genius. The second thing about him is he inherited his father's ability to lead people, and not just any kind of leadership, but a particular ability to lead diverse followings. And his father built these camps of laborers from all over the Islamic world, Africa, Pakistan, India, Asia, the Arab world, and then engineers from Italy and accountants from the United States. And this ability to manage up and down and across all of the world's sort of splendid diversity is a characteristic of Al-Qaeda, a unique and very powerful characteristic of Al-Qaeda. Osama's been able to attract followers from Asia and Africa and Europe and even in some cases from the United States. And he's never given the impression that he discriminates on the basis of race or language group or origin. Third, very quickly, he's a businessman. He has business administration skills. He's a very talented marketer. He's built a brand. And I don't think he would have done that if he hadn't come from the bin Laden family. And finally, you know, he's a performer. He, from the very beginning, had a talent, though he's a quieter personality than Salim, he had a talent for the camera and for the stage. And there are these videos now, whenever I see him with his sort of dyed beard and his gold robes that have been very carefully pressed for the occasion. You know, now I can't help but think of Solomon, his House of the Rising Suns in seven languages, and to see this sense of the stage and the possibility of the stage as a powerful part of his success.
Well, there's a microphone back there, so questions from the audience. How about over here? Yeah.
Thank you for your talk.
It's on.
Okay, great. Thank you for your talk. It's very interesting. But outside of the diabolical success of Osama, how exceptional is the bin Laden family among wealthy families in Saudi Arabia?
I think they're exceptional in several ways. They certainly belong to a group of exceptional, successful business families. They're not the only one, but they are distinctive in a number of ways. First, they belong to the immigrant entrepreneurial community in Saudi Arabia. They are outsiders, which both shapes their sense of global possibility and also makes them distinctive in social terms in Saudi Arabia. But the greatest source of distinction that they possess is the inheritance that Muhammad achieved as the sole contractors and renovators of Mecca, Medina, and for a time, Jerusalem. This is a source of great prestige in Saudi Arabia, and it does provide them, not with political status. I mean, they're not political movers and shakers. Very few business families have ever played that role, and the ones that have, like the Ali Rezas, are of a different character than the bin Ladens. But they belong to, I think, an elite strata, but and are distinctive, but they're certainly not the only business family of that scale or success.
Here. Can you tell us about Al-Qaeda, how that came about?
Yes. Al-Qaeda was created in some meetings in Peshawar and along the Afghan frontier in the summer of 1988. The minutes of the first meetings from August show that the discussions really began in earnest about 3 months after Salim disappeared from the scene. So you have this context, again, of the family kind of being untethered, and Osama now with his own rising ambition and his own sense of possibility. Perhaps that's entirely coincidental. I tend to see some connections there. But in any event, Al-Qaeda was formed between Osama and his Egyptian sort of partners who had started to have a conversation about where do we go now that we've beaten the Soviet Union. And Al-Qaeda was created essentially to start to seed the answer to that question. And its global ambitions really evolved over then from its formation, evolved over a period of 8 years or so until Osama returned to Afghanistan and actually then focused on the United States. In those intervening 8 years, there were periods of real decline and periods of real activity. There was a coherent leadership, a continuous leadership that Osama provided, but it started in this fairly modest atmosphere of political seminar.
There was one at this corner over here. This gentleman right there, yeah.
Who's in charge of the Bin Laden family now, and what's his background? Is it a Westerner?
From second from our left, the gentleman in the white robe there, standing at the third from, I'm sorry, second from the right, yeah, and third from the right is Salem, and then to Salem's left is his full brother, Bucker. Now, Bucker graduated from the University of Miami with an engineering degree in 1971 or so. His classmates recall him as one of the few people on the University of Miami campus in the 1960s who was indifferent to marijuana riots, the Vietnam War, and the convention in Miami in 68. He instead drove around in a pink Cadillac and polyester shirts, and he was married and had a house with a swimming pool where he already had some young children who now carry American passports. And Bucker is a very solid character, a very Arabian character. America didn't stick with him the way it stuck with Salem, but he was comfortable in it. And I think of him as a very sort of centrist Saudi, always a little bit shadowed by Salem's charisma, but a natural sort of efficient heir to Salem's leadership and someone who's actually built great wealth for the family because he's been a much more sort of traditional businessman. And he's now in his early 60s and is a very wealthy and reputable businessman in Saudi Arabia. He flies also, as Salem did. But anyway, the book describes him as always, at least in the view, perhaps over-controlled by Salem's friends, but still as someone who was a sort of a junior Salem and lived a little bit in Salem's shadow, but now quite successful in his own right, certainly very, very wealthy.
Yes, here.
How many wives does Osama have and children, and do you know where they are?
Yes, he has married at least five times, and he has perhaps 20 or 25 children. The full number has never really been inventoried, to my knowledge, although it may be inventoried in some file that I don't have access to. But he and his friends growing up observing their father's behavior actually had these conversations in which they said, well, we believe that Islam does permit four wives, but we think this sort of serial rotation thing that our fathers did is a bit unseemly. And they sort of pledged to one another to actually just have four wives. And that was what Osama more or less did. And he, by the time he went into exile, he had a large family, but a stable one. And his wives were quite well-educated. The first was a very young cousin who was not particularly well-educated. But his second and third, or his third and fourth, both had PhDs in Islamic studies from Saudi universities, but still they're very serious people. And ultimately, though, many of them traveled with him as far as Sudan. One or two left him when he was forced to go to Afghanistan. He then took the remainder of his family with him to Afghanistan and married one new wife, a young Yemeni wife. And then before 9/11, he basically sent everybody home. The wives all went home over time. The daughters have all gone home. And the sons have sort of divided themselves. Some are back. This character, Omar, you may have noticed in the news, the one who recently surfaced in baseball caps and jeans and married some British woman who is in her late 50s, and he's 25, and he met her while horseback riding at the pyramids or something. He seems a little bit disoriented now that he's returned from Afghanistan to modern society. But a number of his sons are quite well integrated into the family. One runs an advertising agency in Jeddah that I visited called Fame Advertising. He seems to have his father's gift for marketing, but he's trying to use it in service of business causes. But there are at least a couple of sons who are still in exile and are thought to be potential heirs of his in the Al-Qaeda project.
Yes, this gentleman in the back row right here.
Yeah. When he formed Al-Qaeda, if you could list the sins of the West and his, and how important each one was, for example, Israel, the corrupt government in Saudi Arabia, etc., which were the presence of American troops in Saudi Arabia, which were the one, which or all are the most important to him?
It's a very interesting question, because I think the answer is different at those first meetings in 88. There, it's not so much a specific project targeted at the United States or even at a particular list of governments, though the Egyptians were always quite anxious to get after the Egyptian government, which had tortured them and sent them into exile. But Osama, I think, was his initial answer to that was a bit vague and more aspirational, but it developed. And the first event that caused it to crystallize was the arrival of the United States and international troops in Saudi Arabia after Saddam invaded Kuwait. Then he interpreted the U.S. mission to Somalia to intervene in the famine and civil war there in late 1992 as an imperialist effort to occupy Muslim lands. And then he began to interpret events in the Balkans and in the former Soviet Union and Tajikistan and elsewhere as all evidence of essentially a global conspiracy to occupy Islamic lands by atheist forces led by the United States.
Down here.
Yeah, hi. I've always thought that one of the major strategic goals of Osama in attacking 9/11 was to put a wedge between the American government and the Saudi government, and then possibly give him an opening within Saudi Arabia. In your studies, have you, what's his ultimate thing? Would he like to be the prophet in Arabia? Would he like to be the caliph of Mecca, or does he see himself more agitational?
It's a very interesting question. I mean, it's a very subtle question, and one that I try to wrestle with in the book in some subtlety. But I think the essential answer is that he sees himself more as an agitator. So actually, what he sees himself as is a vanguard of a global Islamic revolution, and almost in Leninist terms. But And he has never aspired to be the leader, and that has actually made him much more effective as a leader, because people see him as a sincere organizer of other people's agendas rather than someone who's attempting to aggrandize his own power. Now, he obviously has an enormous ego, and this leaks through. And there are clearly moments, especially in the mid-1990s, where he's tempted by your alternative formulation, where he's trying to essentially argue his way into a new Saudi Arabia where a more righteous Islamic wing of the Saudi royal family essentially stages a coup against the more secular wing and then invites him in as the leader of the bin Laden family. Because then you can see these traces also of struggle with his brothers, particularly after Salim's death. I don't think that he ever fully signs up for Bakr's leadership. I think that he basically feels that he is also, at this stage, quite a prestigious figure with a more righteous philosophy, blending business and jihad and God's will on earth and so forth. And so he doesn't ever speak that very loudly, but it does leak through if you read all the texts.
How about in the corner right there? Yes. Mm-hmm.
What is the connection between the bin Ladens and the Bush family?
Well,
did the Bush family have anything to do with the flying of the bin Ladens out of the country?
Well, I think the president was almost certainly informed about it. So, yes, George W. Bush would have signed off on it, although I'm not sure the record exactly describes how he made that decision or when he was informed about it. But it seems safe to assume that he did approve it. The Bush family has had a number of documented business relationships or investments that overlapped with the bin Ladens. George H.W. Bush, the president of the United States between 1988 and 1992, was a promoting partner or principal of a private investment firm called the Carlyle Group that solicited investments from the bin Laden family and won those investments to the multi-million dollar scale. But these were like hedge fund investments. So you essentially put your money into a fund and you expected the Carlyle Group to reward you with a return. But in the course of soliciting and sort of managing those investments, the Bush family had direct contact with the bin Laden family during the 1990s. And James Baker, who was George H.W. Bush's Secretary of State, also seems to have represented the bin Laden family in the 1990s at the time when Bucker's branch of the family was trying to decide how to manage its interests in the United States as Osama went off the reservation. And in particular, they were being requested by the FBI and the U.S. Embassy and the Central Intelligence Agency for cooperation in the emerging effort to get at Osama. And the family seems to have provided some cooperation, but as you'll see in the book, which I hope you'll read, there remained disputes among those involved about how cooperative the family really was. And in particular, some of the FBI agents involved in the investigation and the CIA officers involved in the investigation blame the lawyers that the bin Ladens acquired for sort of thwarting their efforts to get a fuller understanding of what they were dealing with. And Baker seems to have been one of the lawyers that the bin Ladens consulted in this time for advice. And they were concerned, for instance, about Treasury Department sanctions that might freeze the family's money as a way to either punish Osama or because there had been some fact-finding of family culpability. And these were the kinds of things that they kind of lawyered up to deal with as 9/11 approached.
And they stood to lose a lot of money should their assets be frozen.
Yes, and they started to unwind their U.S. holdings almost at the moment that Osama started to emerge as a potential threat. And by the time 9/11 came, they really didn't own the kind of their U.S. investments, while extensive and in some cases entertaining, were never a very great share of their fortune. But that which they did have here, they pulled out, excepting the Carlyle Group, which they continued to have an investment in. In fact, Osama's half-brother Shafiq was in the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C. on the morning of 9/11 when the planes went into the Pentagon, and he was at an investors' conference for Carlyle. And one of the fascinating things about the birth records is that, remember that cluster of sons that I referred to all being born around the same time? Well, Shafiq seems to have been born within weeks of Osama in 1958. They were both singleton sons. So on that many years later, one of them's in the Ritz-Carlton and the other one's sending a plane into Washington.
Two more?
Yeah.
Okay, how about this gentleman right here?
During your investigations of the bin Laden family and then Osama, you mentioned earlier that the use of cell phones in the attack on the two African embassies. Did you find additional information connecting Osama bin Laden to the 9/11 attacks during your research?
Well, yes. I mean, I think the most convincing, essentially at this stage, my reading of the record is that neither Osama bin Laden nor al-Qaeda rejects his authorship or certainly his co-authorship of the 9/11 attacks. And the most powerful piece of evidence is the tape that was discovered in Afghanistan describing Osama's meeting with a visiting sheikh from Saudi Arabia in November of 2001. And it's sort of the kind of videos that al-Qaeda routinely made to document conversations among visiting dignitaries. And they're sitting around and Osama speaks at length about his own experience of the September 11th attacks, and it's quite chilling. He describes how he originally, as a building engineer, thought that the heat and the impact might cause one or two floors to collapse upon each other, but that he never anticipated structural failure. He talks in detail about that. He talks about how he spoke to his colleagues when the news came across the either the radio or the television. He doesn't make clear. And it's essentially a very full account of his own sense of participation in the attacks and his own involvement in the planning. And I believe that tape to be authentic, and Al-Qaeda has never suggested that it's anything but authentic.
And the final, right there. Yeah, right. Yes.
Well, your book is about the family, the bin Ladens. Can you explain to us a little of the many relatives and many who grew up in the same era? Are there any others who are inclined the way, have the same thought patterns or beliefs as he does? And then my second part was, what are the bin Laden interests and relationships, the family's relationship with the U.S. these days?
On the first question, I came to think of the 54, that generation, as I got to know something. I got to know more about the sons and the daughters, but I was able to locate almost everybody in some credible account of their way of living, their choices, and something about their personality. And you came to think of them almost the way you'd think of like a political party in parliament with wings. You know, so there's sort of extreme westernized wings, and there's an extreme religious wing, and then there's a kind of a broad center that's trying to balance things, which I sort of locate Bucker in that center. And on the Osama wing of the family, he was not alone. There were a number of sisters and one or two brothers who certainly shared his views of what a righteous Islamic life looked like. There's no suggestion that they participated in the violence that he later embraced, but they certainly grew up with him in the broader sort of flow of Islamist ideology and even transnational Islamist ideology in Saudi Arabia. And so in that sense, he wasn't isolated. As to the family today, the six or seven brothers and sisters where we began this conversation who were evacuated, one or two of them have come back, to my understanding, from time to time, but it's difficult for them. You can imagine the airport experience time and again. The Raji, the woman who flew out on the initial flight, who lived in L.A., flew out in the first place because of her, difficulty of how do you pay for things with this credit card and that sort of thing. So my impression is that by and large they've stopped coming, and some of them have testified in post 9/11 legal proceedings involving family law cases that they're afraid to come back. Maybe not all of them feel that way, but some of them clearly do. On the other hand, the kids, the generation of college students, the ones who got aboard that plane talking about their fake IDs and that sort of thing, and some of them have American passports as well. My impression is that they're a little more comfortable with this ambiguous status that they have to deal with. And I think they're here more often. Some of them actually live and work here. Of course, the famous Wafa bin Laden, who's sort of a singer in New York and has appeared in GQ in a state of not undressed, but un-Islamic dress, I would say.
Well, thanks, Steve, for coming and talking about this fascinating book you've written.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.